This is Audible.
Audible Frontiers presents Legacy, a prequel to Eon. Written by Greg Bear. Narrated by Stefan Rudnicki.
Prologue. Journey Year 753. I stood on the lip of the southern borehole, clutching a service line, and for the first time in my life stared beyond the mass of thistledown at the stars. They spread through deep space, as many and sharp as a cloud of crystal snow blown against black onyx. The uncharted constellations spun with a stately haste, betraying the asteroid's rotation around its long axis. The worksuit performed its tasks silently, and for a time I seemed a point of crystal myself, at the center of the crystal empyrean, at peace. I looked for patterns in the stars, but before I could find any, my companion interrupted me.
Olmi?
She pulled herself carefully along the line and floated beside me.
Just a moment, I said. We're done here. Parties await us, Olmi. Celebrations and diversions. But you're a bonded man, aren't you?
I shook my head, annoyed. Hard to believe that something as huge as thistledown can shrink to nothing, I said. Her expression, surveying the stars, was half worry, half distaste. Caria Ap Kane had been my partner in Way Defense since basic. A good friend, if not exactly a soulmate. I had so few soulmates. Not even my bond. Give me a minute, Caria.
I want to get back.
She shrugged.
All right, a minute. But why look outward?
Caria would never have understood. To her, the asteroid starship was all and everything. A world of infinite social opportunities, work, friends, even dying for Way Defense if it came to that. The stars were outside, far south, and meant nothing. Only the confined infinity of the Way aroused wonder in her soul.
It's pretty, she said flatly. Do you think we'll ever get to Vanbrugh?
Vanbrugh's star, still 100 light-years distant, had been the original goal of Thistledown. For most of the ship's population of Naderites, my family included, it was the point of all our existences, a holy destination, and had been for 700 years journey time.
Can we see it from here, do you think?
No, I said. It's visible from midline this year.
Too bad, Caria said.
She clucked her tongue restlessly. The 10-kilometer-wide crater at Thistledown's southern pole had once deflected and directed the pulses of the Beckman drive motors. The motors had not been fired in 4 centuries. I took one last look beyond the lip of the borehole, my eyes tracking outward along the honeycombed curve of the dimple at the center of the crater. Huge, black, many-limbed robots sat in the dimple around the lip of the borehole, having arranged themselves for our inspection hours earlier. All right, I said to the masked robots. Go home. I aimed the command transponder and the machines backed away, hooks and claws grabbing the spinning slope, returning to their duties on the asteroid's surface. We turned and pulled ourselves along the line down the borehole, toward the tube rider, an oblate grayness resting lightly against the dark rock and metal wall. Beyond the tube rider lay the massive prime dock, a cylinder within the borehole designed to counter-rotate and allow easier access to cargo vehicles. Tens of kilometers north glowed a small bright dot, the opening to the first chamber. We climbed into the tube rider, pressurized the cramped cabin, and collapsed our work suits. Caria beamed a signal at the borehole mouth. 2 massive shutters swung from the walls and came together like black-lipped jaws, sealing this end of Thistledown and blanking the stars.
All clean and clear, she said. Agreed?
All clear and clean, I said.
Do the generals actually think the Jarts will get outside the Way and swing up our backside?
Caria asked cheerfully. They surprised us once, I said. They might do it again. Caria gave me a dubious grin.
Shall I drop you off at the 6th chamber? She asked,
lifting the vehicle away from the wall. I need to do some things in Thistledown City first.
Ever the mystery man, Caria said.
She had no idea. We sped north down the tunnel. The kilometers to the end of the borehole passed rapidly. The entrance to the 1st chamber yawned wide, and we flew into brilliant tube light. 50 kilometers in diameter and 30 deep, the first chamber seemed to my recent interstellar perspective to be little more than the inside of a big squat drum. Its true size was emphasized by the slowness with which our tube rider crossed to the borehole in the chamber's northern cap. Clouds decked the chamber floor 25 kilometers below. The atmosphere in the chamber rose to a height of 20 kilometers, a sea of fluid lining the drum. I saw a small storm gathering on the floor overhead. No storm could touch us at the axis, riding as we were in almost perfect vacuum. The first chamber was kept nearly deserted as a precaution against any breach of the comparatively thin walls of the asteroid at the southern end. We traveled down the middle of the tube light, a translucent pipe of glowing plasma 5 kilometers wide and 30 long, generated at the chamber's northern and southern caps. We could see rapid pulses of light from our position along the axis, but on the chamber's floor, the tube presented a steady yellow-white glow day and night. So it was in all of the first 6 chambers. The 7th chamber, of course, was different. The borehole seemed a pinprick in the gray, gently curved wall of asteroid rock ahead of us. "Shall I go manual and thread us in?" Caria asked, grinning at me. I smiled back, but gave no answer. She was good enough to do it. She had piloted flawships and numerous other craft up and down the way with expert ease. "I'd rather relax," she said, peeved by my silence. "You would refuse to be impressed." She folded her arms back behind her head. "Besides, it's been a long day. I might miss."
"You never miss," I said.
"Damn right I don't."
Inspections were mandated by Hexamon law twice yearly. Way Defense had upped that to 4 times yearly, with special emphasis on 6th chamber security, inspection of reserve batteries in the ship's cold outer walls, and maintenance of the southern borehole and external monitors. This time, Caria and I had drawn inspection duty for the far south. We then had liberty for 30 days, and Caria thought herself lucky. The Way's 25th anniversary celebration was just beginning. But I had an unpleasant task ahead. Betrayal. Separation. Putting an end to connections I no longer believed in, but was not willing to mock. The cap loomed, filling our forward view, and the second borehole suddenly swallowed us. Kilometers away, the opening to the second chamber city, Alexandria, made another brilliant dot against the tunnel's unlighted blackness.
"Elevator, or shall I swoop down and drop you off somewhere?"
"Elevator," I said.
"My," Caria said with a cluck. "Glum?"
"You sound like a chicken," I said.
"You've never seen a live chicken. How can you be glum with so much liberty ahead?"
"Even so." We passed into the second chamber, the same size as the first, but filled with Thistledown's oldest city. Alexandria covered 2/3 of the second chamber floor, 3,100 square kilometers of glorious white and gold and bronze and green towers, arrayed in spirals and stepped ranks, walls of blunt-faced black and gold cubes, ornately inscribed spheres rising from massive cradles themselves rich with colors and populations. Between the city and the southern cap stretched a blue-green river, 1 kilometer wide and several meters deep, flowing beneath the graceful suspension bridges spaced at the floor's 4 quarters. In Thistledown's original designs, the parks along the capside bank did not exist. In their place had risen a slosh barrier 100 meters higher than the opposite shore to mitigate the effects of the ship's acceleration. But in the early days of Thistledown's construction, that problem had been solved by the inertial damping machinery in the 6th chamber. The same machinery centuries later had allowed Konrad Korzenowski to contemplate creating the Way. The chamber floor was flat, not banked. The park and the river formed bands of green and blue around the chamber's southern end. Parks and forests covered the open spaces between neighborhoods. In plots scattered around the city, robots labored to finish structures destined to absorb the slowly growing population. Thistledown was ever young. After 7 centuries, the asteroid's inhabitants numbered 75 million. She had begun her voyage with 5 million. Caria clucked again and shook her head.
We passed over Alexandria and into the third borehole. Near the northern opening, she slowed the vehicle and sidled up against a raised entrance. A transfer passage reached across to the door of the tube rider, and I disembarked. I waved to Caria and stepped into the green and silver elevator. The air smelled of moisture and people. The clean but unmistakably human perfume of the city where I had lived 2 years of my youth.
"See you in a few days,"
Caria said, looking after me with some concern. "Yeah."
"Cheers."
I leaned my head to one side and said goodbye to her. On the way down, I told my uniform to become civilian standard day dress style 1, mildly formal. I wanted to avoid attracting attention as a member of Way Defense, not at all that common in the Naderite community. The elevator took 9 minutes to reach the chamber floor. I stepped out and walked down the short corridor into the chamber proper. I crossed the Shahrazad Bridge, listening to the whisper of the slender Far River and the wind-blown rustle of thousands of long red ribbons blowing from the wires in the gentle breeze from the southern cap. Some neighborhood had chosen this decoration for the bridge this month. In another month, it might be crawling with tiny glowing robots. Thistledown City had been built in the first 2 centuries after the starship's departure. With its chamber-spanning catenary cables reaching from cap to cap and hung with slender white buildings, it seemed to dwarf Alexandria. It was obviously a Geshel showplace. And yet, in the worst conflicts between Geshels and Naderites on the starship after the opening of the Way, many conservative and radical Naderites had been forced to move from their homes in Alexandria to new quarters in Thistledown City. There were still strong Naderite neighborhoods near the southern cap. New construction was underway here as well, with arches being erected parallel to the caps, the greatest planned to be 10 kilometers long. A short walk took me to the tall cylindrical building where I had spent my early childhood. Through round hallways filled with sourceless illumination, my shadow forming and dissolving in random arcs around me, I returned to our old apartment. My parents were away in Alexandria to escape the celebrations. I had known that before coming here. I entered the apartment and sealed the door, then turned to the memory plaques in the living center. For 24 years, I had kept one important secret known to me and perhaps one other, the man or woman or being who had placed the old friend in this particular building, not anticipating that an inquisitive child might come upon him almost by accident. I had come here to check up on a friend who had died before I was born, in his perfect hiding place, and make certain he was still hidden and undisturbed. I, and no more than that one other, I was convinced, knew the last resting place of the great Konrad Korzenowski. The tomb, not of his body, but of what remained of his personality after his assassination by radical Naderites. I connected with the building's memory, used a mouse agent to bypass personal sentries, as I had decades ago and at least once a year since, and dropped into the encrypted memory store. "Hello," I said. The presence stirred. Even without a body, it seemed to smile. It was no longer human, half its character having been destroyed, but it could still interact and share warm memories. What remained of the great Korzenowski was vulnerably friendly. All of its caution removed, all of its self-protections destroyed, it could only be one thing, a giving and occasionally brilliant friend, ideal for a lonely young child unsure of himself. I kept this secret for one reason. Damaged personalities could not be repaired by Naderite law. If what remained of Korzenowski were to be discovered, it would be erased completely. "Hello, Olmi," it answered. "How is the way?" An hour later, I cabbed across the city to the mixed Geshel and Naderite progressive neighborhoods, favored by students and Way Defense members. There, in my small apartment, I linked with city memory, sent my planned locations for the next few days to the Corps commanders, and removed my mutable uniform for purely civilian garb appropriate to the celebration. Sky blue pants, earth brown vest, pale green jacket, and light boots. I returned to the train station. As I joined the throng waiting on the platform, I looked for familiar faces and found none. 4 years in service guarding against the Jarts on the extreme frontiers of the Way, 4 billion kilometers north of Thistledown, had given my Geshel acquaintances from university time to change not just partners and philosophies, but body patterns as well. If any of my student friends were in the crowd, I probably would not recognize them. I did not expect to find many Way defenders here. Except for raccoon stripes of pale blue around my eyes, I was still physically the same as I had been 4 years before. Arrogant, full of my own thoughts, headstrong and sometimes insensitive, judged brilliant by many of my peers and moody by many more. Attractive to women in that strange way women are attracted to those who might hurt them, the only child of the most mannered and gracious of parents, praised frequently and punished seldom, I had reached my 30th year, convinced of my courage from a minimum of testing, yet even more convinced there would be greater tests in store. I had abandoned the faith of my father, and in truth, had never understood the faith of my mother. Thistledown, immense as it was, did not seem capable of containing my ambition. I did not think I was young, and certainly did not feel inexperienced. After all, I had served 4 years in Way Defense. I had participated in what seemed at the time to be important actions against the Jarts. Yet now, caught up in crowds celebrating the silver anniversary of Thistledown's wedding with the Way, I seemed an anonymous bubble in a flowing stream, smaller than I had felt among the stars. What I was about to do dismayed me. Music and pictures flowed over the largely Geshel crowd. Narrative voices telling the details we all knew, Naderites and Geshels alike, by heart. 25 years before, Korzhenovsky and his assistants had completed, connected, and opened the Way. From my childhood, the Way had beckoned, the only place, if place it could be called, likely to provide the tests I craved. In the history of humankind, has there ever been anything more audacious? Issuing from Thistledown's seventh chamber, the inside, there is no outside, of an endless immaterial pipe, 50 kilometers in diameter, smooth barren surface the color of newly cast bronze, the Way is a universe turned inside out, threaded by an axial singularity called the Flaw. And at regular intervals along the surface of the Way, potential openings to other places and times, histories and realities strung like beads. My parents, and most of my friends during my early youth, were devoted Naderites of that semi-orthodox persuasion known as Voyagers. They believed it was simple destiny for humankind to have carved 7 chambers out of the asteroid Juno, attached Beckman drive motors, and converted the huge planetesimal into a starship christened Thistledown. They believed, as did all but the extreme Naderites, that it was right and just to transport millions across the vast between the stars to settle fresh new worlds. Our family had lived for centuries in Alexandria, in the second and third chambers. We had all been born on Thistledown. We knew no other existence. They simply did not believe in the creation of the Way. That, virtually all Naderites agreed, had been an abomination of Korzhenovsky and the overly ambitious Geshels. By releasing the bond between myself and the woman chosen for me in my youth at Ripon, I would finally end my life as a Naderite. The trains arrived with a flourish as sheets of red and white arced over the train station. The crowd roared like a monstrous but happy animal and pushed me across the platform to the doors spread wide to receive us. I was lost in a sea of faces, smiling, grimacing, laughing, or just intent on keeping upright in the jostle. We packed into the trains so closely we could scarcely move. A young woman jammed against me. She glanced up at me, face flushed, smiling happily but a little scared. She wore Geshel fashion, but by the cut of her hair, I saw she was from a Naderite family. Rebelling, cutting loose, joining the Geshel crowds on this least holy of celebrations, perhaps not caring in the least what the celebration was about. "What's your name?" she asked, nibbling her lower lip as if expecting some rebuff.
Olmi, I said. You're lovely. With the mask. Did you do it yourself?
I smiled down at her. She was perhaps 5 years younger than I. Years past ripen. An adult by any measure, Naderite or Geshel, but out of her place. She rubbed against me in the jostle, half deliberate. I felt little attraction to her, but some concern.
You're going to see the way? Visit Axis City? I asked, bending to whisper in her ear.
Yes,
she answered, eyes dancing.
And you?
Eventually.
Family meeting you there?
She flushed crimson.
No,
she said. Bond meeting you there?
No.
I'd think again, I said. Geshels can get pretty wild when they party. The way makes them drunk. She drew back, blinking.
It's my hair, isn't it?
She said, lips flicking down suddenly. She fought to get away from me, pushing through the thick pack, glancing over her shoulder resentfully. For the young, and at 30, in a culture where one could live to be centuries, I could not think of myself as anything but very young. To be a Geshel was infinitely more exciting than being a Naderite. We all lived within a miracle of technology, and it seemed the soul of Thistledown had grown tired of confinement. The Geshels, who embraced the most extreme technologies and changes, offered the glamour of infinite adventure down the way, contrasted with the weary certainty of centuries more in space, traveling with Thistledown in search of unknown planets around a single distant star. Truly, we had outstripped the goals of our ancestors. To many of us, it seemed irrational to cling to an outmoded philosophy. Yet something tugged at me, a lost sense of comfort and certainty. The train passed through the asteroid rock beneath Thistledown City, more news of the celebration projected over the faces of the passengers. Stylized songs and histories flowed over and around us.
For 25 years, the way has beckoned to pioneers, an infinite frontier filled with inexhaustible mystery and danger. Though created by the citizens of Thistledown, even before it was opened, the way was parasitized by intelligences both violent and ingenious, the Jarts. With the Jart influence now pushed back beyond the first 2 billion kilometers of the way, gates have been opened at a steady pace and new worlds discovered.
I pressed through the crowd and left the train in the fourth chamber. The open-air platform held only a few sightseers, mostly Naderites, fleeing to the countryside of forests and waterways and deserts and mountains to escape the celebration. But even here, the sky that filled the cylindrical chamber flashed with bright colors. The yellow-white tube light that spanned the chamber's axis had been transformed into a pulsing work of art.
"They're overstepping it,"
grumbled an older Naderite man on the platform, dignified in his gray and blue robes. His wife nodded agreement. 20 kilometers above us, the tube light sparkled and glittered green and red. Snake-like lines of intense white writhed within the glow. Forests rose on all sides of the station and resort buildings. From the floor, the chamber's immensity revealed itself with deceptive gradualness. For 5 kilometers on each side, as one stared along a parallel to the flat gray walls of asteroid rock and metal capping the cylinder, the landscape appeared flat, as it might have seemed on Earth. But the cylinder's curve lofted the land into a bridge that met high overhead, 50 kilometers away. Lakes and forests and mountains suspended in a haze of atmosphere, transected by the unusual gaiety of the tube light. In the early days, the chambers had been called squirrel cages. Though immense, they were roughly of the same proportions. The entire ship spun around its long axis, centrifugal force pressing things to the chamber floors with an acceleration of 6/10 Earth's gravity. My heart felt dull as lead. The station platform was just a few kilometers from the Vishnu Forest, where my bond would be waiting for me. I walked, glad for the delay and the exercise. Ulesa Ramdonnell stood alone by the outside rail beneath the pavilion where we had once jointly celebrated our ripen. We had been 10 then. She leaned against the wooden railing, backed by the giant trunks of redwood trees as old as Thistledown. a small black figure on the deserted dance floor. The high white dome shielded her from the rainbow flows of the tube light. I walked up the steps slowly, and she watched with arms folded, face going quickly from pleasure at seeing me to concern. We had spent enough time together to prepare for being man and wife. We knew each other well enough to sense moods. We embraced under the high white pine dome.
"You've been neglectful," she said. "I've missed you."
Ulaysa was as tall as I, and after we kissed, she regarded me at a level, large black eyes steady and a little narrowed by lids drawn with unspoken suspicion. Her face was lovely, clearly marked by intelligence and concern, nose gently arced, chin rounded and slightly withdrawn. Our bond was special to our parents. They hoped for a strong Naderite union leading into city and perhaps even shipwide politics. Her parents had spoken of our becoming Hexamon representatives, joint administrators, part of the resurgence in Naderite leadership.
"You've changed," Ulaysa said. "Your postings..."
For a moment I saw something like little girl panic in her eyes. I said what I had to say, not proudly and not too quickly. My numbness grew into a kind of shock.
"Where will you go?" she asked. "What will you do?"
"Another life," I said.
"Do I bore you so much?"
"You have never bored me," I said with some anger. "The flaws are mine."
"Yes," she said, eyes slitted, teeth clenched. "I think they must be. All yours."
I wanted to kiss her, to thank her for the time we had had, the growing up, but I should have done that before I spoke. She pushed me away, held out her hands, and shook her head quickly. I walked from beneath that dome, feeling at once miserable and free. Back on still another crowded train to the sixth chamber, I simply felt empty. Ulaysa had not cried. I had not expected her to. She was strong and proud, and would have no difficulty finding another bond. But we both knew one thing. I had betrayed her and the plans of our families. I intended to sink myself wholeheartedly into the celebrations, getting off the train in the sixth chamber, standing in the Korzhenovsky Center with other celebrants waiting to be carried by construction cars to the seventh. I watched patters of rain fall from the thick clouds onto the transparent roof. It almost always rained in the sixth chamber. The carpets of machinery that covered most of the chamber, transferring and shaping forces that were beyond my own comprehension, created heat that needed to be drained away, and this ancient method had proved best. I thought of Ulaysa's face, her narrowed eyes, and an unexpected stab of grief hit me. My awareness of where I was and who I was curled inward like a snail's horns. Implants did not stop me from having negative emotions, and I did not try to blank them. Ulaysa had no affect controls. I deserved my own share of suffering. Someone touched me, and I thought for a moment I was blocking a line into the cars, but the cars had not yet arrived. I turned and saw Janosz Apkessler.
"You look all beaten up," he said.
"Without the bruises." I smiled grimly. "It's my own fault," I said. He wore around his neck the pictor then becoming fashionable, though he did not speak in Picts with me. Otherwise, his dress was of the style called atonic, mildly conservative, blue and beige mid-waist, black leggings, charcoal gray slippers, all fabrics flat, lacking image inlays.
"Yes, well, I've been trying to reach you for 2 days now."
"I've been on duty," I said. Janosz was an old friend. We had met as youths at the Naderite Union College in Alexandria. I had performed favors, not too difficult, that obscured some of his less discreet escapades. All in all, he had been a better judge of circumstance and character, and had risen in his career much more rapidly than I. But I was in no real mood for companionship, even his.
"That's how I traced you. I convinced someone I needed to learn your whereabouts, desperately."
"Rank hath its privileges," I said. He frowned and half-twisted his upper body before turning to shoot back at me.
"Stop being so damned opaque. Where are you going?"
"To the seventh chamber. Axis City? Eventually."
Join me. No need to wait in line.
4 months before, Janosch had been elected as third administrator for the Seventh Chamber and the Way. He had come to this center of power and activity from a background similar to mine. Son of devout Naderites, he had gravitated to the Geshels shortly after the opening of the Way, as so many others had. We all respected the philosophy of the good man, crusader and wary critic of the technology that had brought on the death, but that had been 10 centuries before. More privilege? I asked.
Just friendship, Janosch said.
You haven't spoken to me in a year.
You haven't exactly made yourself accessible, Janosch said.
I might prefer crowds now.
It's important, Janosch said.
He took my arm. I hung back, but he tightened his grip. Rather than be dragged, I relented and walked beside him. He palmed his way through a security door, and we walked down a chill hallway to a maintenance shaft. Lights formed a line down a long, wide tunnel, vanishing north into darkness. What could be so important?
You can listen to something incredible as a favor, Janosch said. And maybe I can save your career.
He whistled, and a small, sleek cab with Nexus markings came out of the shadows, floating a few centimeters above the gritty black floor.
You're being investigated by the Naderites, Janosch told me as the cab traversed the tunnel in the wall between the sixth and seventh chambers.
Why? I asked, smiling ironically. I'm in Way defense. I've just cut myself off from the last Naderite ritual in my life.
I know, he said.
Poor Ulesa. If I were you, I'd have tried to convince her to come with me. She's a fine woman.
I wouldn't do that to her, I said, staring through the window at the flashing maintenance lights.
Lumbering dark robots moved aside to allow our quick passage.
She tolerated my lapses. She didn't agree with them.
Still, she might have appreciated being tempted.
Should I look her up and console her? Janosch asked.
It's about time I found a family triad.
I shrugged, but some tick of my expression amused him.
Much as I need to renew my connections with the Voyagers now, I wouldn't be so rude, he said. The Naderites are going to push for control of the Nexus in a few weeks. They'll probably get it. The cost of pushing back the Jarts is drawing grumbles even among the hardiest Geshel administrators. If Naderites take over, the Nexus changes its face, and all us juniors get drudge work for a decade. My administrator's career is hanging by a few thin threads, and I might add, the Way could be in peril.
I stared at him, genuinely shocked.
They couldn't put together the coalition to do that.
Never underestimate the people who made us.
The cab emerged on a straight highway beneath brilliant pearly light, tan and snow-colored sand on either side. We were 5 kilometers spinward from the public access to the Seventh Chamber. Behind us, the gray heights of the Seventh Chamber's southern cap receded, an immense cliff wall. Ahead, there was no cap. No end. The Way stretched on forever, or at least into incomprehensible and immeasurable distances. This was what Korzenovsky had done, making the Thistledown bigger on the inside than the outside, opening up endless potential and adventure and danger. And for that, he had been assassinated shortly after the Way's opening. He could not have known about the Jarts.
It's a matter of economic stability, to be sure, Janosch said, but some high passions have been engaged in the past 25 years.
There are gates being opened. Naderites are signing up to immigrate.
Politics isn't a rational art, Janosch said, even on Thistledown. We have too much of Earth in us.
I looked up. In the center of the tube light that flowed from the southern cap, a thin line made itself visible more as an uncanny absence. The creation of the Way had, by some metaphysical necessity I only half understood, made a singularity that ran the length of Korzenovsky's pipe-shaped universe, the Flaw. Threaded on the Flaw, 60 kilometers from the southern cap's borehole, a suspended city was being built a section at a time. Spinward, a new section lay on the empty white sand, covered by robots like ants on a huge sugar cake. It would become the remaining half of Axis Nader, a concession to those forces that did not even believe in the Way. 3 previously threaded sections or precincts of the Axis city already floated over us, white and steel and gray, great cylindrical monuments studded with towers that reached a kilometer and more from their main bodies. The city gleamed, startlingly clear seen through the thinner atmosphere that covered the floor of this section of the way. At the end of the highway, 60 kilometers from the southern cap, a private cable hung from the city overhead. The cab stopped beside the cable's gondola. "What do they think I've done?" I asked Janos.
"I don't know. Nobody does. It's something not even the first administrator of Alexandria is willing to talk about."
"I'm a small soldier in a very big army," I said. "A lowly rank 7. Not worth the fuss."
"That's what the sensible folk are saying. This month, secret allegations too dire to be spoken among extremists who are not supposed to have a voice even with the radicals."
He turned to me as the door to the gondola opened.
"Make any sense?"
It did, but I could never tell him, or anyone else for that matter. Korzhenovsky, in theory, could be revived if Geshels changed the laws. He could become a very powerful symbol. Perhaps the only other who knew had had a change of heart, or had been indiscreet.
"No," I said. "We'll talk more in my office."
Janosch's office opened to an outer wall of the finished first precinct of Axis Nader. Nexus offices clustered like quartz crystals in this external neighborhood.
"Let me counter one absurdity by relating another," Janosch said. "This one's more important by far, actually. Have you ever heard of Jamie Carr Lenk?"
He perched on the edge of his narrow workboard. Details of Axis City construction flashed in display around and behind him. He headed a group of radical Naderites, calling themselves Divaricates. "He disappeared," I said.
"We know where he's gone," Janosch said. "He took 4,000 followers, Divaricates, and a few humble machines, and went off to make Utopia."
I wondered if Janosch was joking. He loved stories of human folly. "Where?" I asked.
"Wrong first question," Janosch said.
He studied my face intently. "The limits of Thistledown were well known. Hiding places could be found, but not for so many. Then the enormity of this disappearance struck me. First, the sheer numbers, 4,000 citizens, and next, the fact that their disappearance had gone unnoticed and unpublicized. I became at once intensely interested and wary.
"How, then?" I asked. "Their devotion to Lenk was complete. They even adopted his name and gave him honorifics, like Nader himself. Each carefully laid a trail of deception. Individually, or as a family or group, they claimed to be off on a knowledge retreat in one chamber or another, in one city or another, under the laws of the Coalition, not to be pursued or questioned by Nexus agencies until they returned to secular life. As well, Lenk chose whole families, husbands with their wives, children with parents, triad groupings together, no loose fragments. They vanished and left nary a ripple 5 years ago. Only Lenk himself was reported missing. The others..."
Janosch shrugged. "Where did he take them?" I asked.
"Down the way," Janosch said. "With the complicity of 2 apprentice gate openers, he created an illegal passage in a geometry stack."
"No one knew?" My amazement grew to incredulity. I was relieved not to have to think about my other predicament, if it was a predicament and not a false alarm. Janosch shrugged again.
"We've been distracted, needless to say, but that's a weak excuse. They chose a stack region near the frontier, close to Jart boundaries. They used the conflict of 748 as a cover. Slipped in behind defense forces, disguised themselves as a support unit. Nobody detected them. They had help, and we're still investigating. Lenk had connections, apparently," Janosch said. "Somebody told him about Lamarckia."
"Lamarckia?" The name sounded exotic.
"A closely held secret."
"The Nexus?" I asked, mocking dismay. "Keeping secrets?" Janosch hardly blinked.
"An extraordinary world was discovered by the first gate prospectors about 12 years ago. Very terrestrial. They named it Lamarckia. There was little time to explore, so after making a brief survey, they closed the gate, marked a node,
and saved it for future study. All such discoveries have been kept secret to prevent just such occurrences as this. How do we know about Lenk after all this time? I asked.
One of the immigrants returned, Yanar said. He stole one of two clavicles in Lenk's possession and came back through a tangle of world lines in the stack. A defense floor ship found him more than half dead in a depleted pressure suit. It brought him here.
Janosz stared through the transparent floor at the immense cranes and webs of cables and flowing strings of purple and green tracting fields lifting pieces of the new precinct from the floor of the way.
Some say we may never be able to return to Lamarckia because of what they've done, he said. Others I trust more say it may be difficult, but not impossible.
The gate openers are disturbed that a clavicle could fall into jarred hands, if they have hands. We could lose control of that region at any time. The Nexus has agreed to send a mid-rank gate opener to check out the damage. They've asked for a single investigator to accompany him. Your name came up. I wasn't the one who brought it up. Oh, I smiled, disbelieving. He did not return my smile.
It may be the most beautiful world we've yet found.
Some Geschels privately speculated Lamarckia might become our refuge if we lost the war. He lifted an eyebrow critically. It's the most Earth-like of the 10 worlds we've had time to open. Why didn't we develop it?
Could we have held it if we did? Janosz asked. The Jarts pushed us beyond that stack, and we pushed them, back and forth 3 times since its discovery.
Little or nothing was known about Jart anatomy, psychology, or history. Even less was known about how they had made their own reversed gate just after the way's creation, and before it had been opened and attached to Thistledown. The Jarts had begun a furious surprise offensive at the moment of the opening, killing thousands. Ever since, the war had been waged unmercifully by both sides, using all the weapons available, including the physics of the way itself. Those who had built it, and who accessed its many realities strung like beads, could also make large stretches of it inhospitable to anything living. Janosz looked at me squarely, intense green eyes challenging.
The Nexus would like someone to cross to Lamarckia and retrieve the remaining clavicle. While that someone is there, he might as well investigate the planet more thoroughly. We know little. A slim surveyor's report. Lamarckia appears to be a paradise, but its biology is unusual. We need to learn what damage Lenk has done.
You didn't suggest me immediately? Janosz smiled. I shook my head dubiously. My reputation is that of a stubborn but capable renegade. I doubt my division commanders would recommend me.
They asked me about you, and I said you could do it. Might even relish something like this. But frankly, this isn't an assignment I'd give to an old friend.
Janosz suspected I was bored as a simple soldier and needed a chance to excel. He knew without my telling him that my personality chafed in way defense. The Jart situation had settled for the time being into a drawn-out stalemate. Being brought into a Nexus action, and a difficult action at that, was a guarantee of rapid advancement if I succeeded. Janosz knew I had once had some social connections with Divaricates. My mother and father had known a number of them. I had once met Jamie Carr Lenk 15 years before. I knew their ways.
Lamarckia has been dropped into my lap by the Geschel leaders in the Nexus, Janosz said.
It's my own kind of trial by fire, and a test. If you agree and succeed, we both benefit. So I said I would ask, but I did not specifically back you.
And the immigrants?
Bringing them back will be politically difficult. Divaricates are peculiar in their attitude toward the way. They abhor it, but they think they can use it. They have always spoken of a homeland away from Thistledown and the Geschels, a new, fresh earth. But in truth, for the time being, the Geschels are still in power in the Nexus, and we're more interested in the planet than in the people. If they've interfered, and it seems inevitable that they would, being who they are, then we'll bring them back, and Lenk will stand trial. It would give the Radicals a bad stain on their record.
That's grim, I said.
Janosz did not disagree.
It's a grand assignment for somebody, he said. An entire planet, yours to explore. Not that it's going to be easy. I have to admit, in some ways it suits you, Omi.
I wondered if I was being too sensitive about my secret. I had not spent the last 5 years just soldiering, and Janosch, or the people behind him, were not the first outside of Way Defense to find me useful. This, however, was well beyond my proven capabilities.
"Are there other reasons I've been chosen?" I asked.
"Whatever you've done to displease the Naderites, this gets you out of the political war zone. The mission could be a kind of oubliette, actually, a tight little closet where nobody can reach you until we sort out the political situation. Whatever it is you're involved in, I've never been other than loyal to the Hexamon," I said. "The Nexus appreciates loyalty as well."
"You make fine distinctions," I said.
"Power comes and goes. I render unto the Caesars." Janosch looked away, eyelids lowered with sudden weariness.
"You've become an enigma to most of our friends. Where do your loyalties lie? With Geshels or with Naderites?"
"Kozhanovsky was a Naderite," I said. "And he built the way."
"He paid for his presumption," Janosch said.
"Where do yours lie?"
"You didn't answer my question.
Fortunately for us all, we don't have to reveal our loyalties to serve in defense or in the Nexus. I've served Geshel ends for years."
"But Ulesa?"
Janosch raised an eyebrow, significant of so many things unsaid, all that had happened since we last met. Throughout our friendship, there had been moments, quite a few of them, when Janosch's perceptiveness irritated me.
"A mistake," I said.
"Not political, personal. But if the Nexus wants something done, why send just one?"
Janosch's look intensified as if he would see through me.
"Your face, your eyes. You've never tried to blend in, have you?"
"I've never had to."
"It's more than that," he shook his head.
"Never mind," he sighed.
"I wish I had been born before the Hexamon opened the way. Things were much simpler and more boring. I wonder how much confidence you have in me."
"To tell the truth, I was maneuvered into agreeing to interview you," Janosch said,
"by skilled tacticians whose motives are never clear. I think you can do the job, of course. I don't think it's my hide thereafter. And if you agree, you'll take considerable pressure off me."
"Somebody values Lamarckia."
"The presiding minister herself," Janosch said.
"So I hear.
She wants to know more about Lamarckia, but can't push a major expedition through the Nexus just now. Jarts must be our main concern. In a way, you're a chip in a massive gamble. The presiding minister will gamble that they can place you on Lamarckia alone to gather information and make judgments. When she convinces the Nexus that a larger team should be sent, their mission will go all the more smoothly. They connect with you, you fill them in, and together we all lay a stronger claim on Lamarckia."
"I see," I said.
"I believe she'll win the gamble, even if the Naderites take control of the Nexus. Her arguments are unassailable. In a few weeks or months, if the geometry stack cooperates, you'll have lots of company. And if they can't get Nexus approval and the gate can't be opened, you'll have to find Link's second clavicle and open your own gate."
"That does sound like an oubliette," I said.
"Nobody believes the mission will be safe or easy."
To me, that sounded like a challenge, as much as Janosch's flickering enthusiasm.
"Perfect," I said. In that small office, with its spectacular view crowded with perspectives of progress on Axis City, I smiled at my old friend.
"Of course I'm interested," I said.
"Interest isn't enough, I fear," Janosch said, pulling back and folding his hands. "I need an answer, soon."
My first instinct was to refuse the assignment. Despite recent setbacks and confusions, I did have my plans, and they had a certain elegance. I also had my responsibilities, which made me far more important and valuable than I seemed, than even Janosch or anyone in the Nexus could know. But I was acutely aware of my lack of experience. My time spent in Way Defense had largely been wasted. "I will be nothing unless I am tested and tempered."
The counter-argument sounded much more compelling. "You'll certainly be nothing if you're dead, or lost and forgotten on a worm closed off from the way." The voice of reason was about to prevail. But another voice leaped ahead and answered for me, the voice my father had warned me about and my mother deplored. "I'll go," I said. Janos gave me a shrewd look, then leaned forward and grabbed my shoulder firmly. Grand impetuosity, it's what I expected. I had become more than a little cynical with my torn loyalties. I did not know who I was any longer. Getting away, completely away, seemed a real solution. My secret would keep, perhaps be in less peril if I was gone. This is the way history sometimes works. Simple connections, simple decisions, with untold consequences. I studied the secret Dalgesh report, made by three surveyors immediately after Lamarckia's discovery. Lamarckia was the second planet of a yellow sun, born in a relatively metal-poor galactic region, not correlated with any known place in our own galaxy. The surveyors had barely had 2 days to do their work before the gate was closed, and so their findings were incomplete. They had left 3 monitors on the largest continent, but had launched no satellites. The photos and recordings showed a world at once familiar and extraordinary. I was particularly interested in Jamie Carr Lenk's logistics planning. The good Lenk had selectively abandoned divaricate restrictions to make the immigration possible. There were no tested and confirmed native foodstuffs on Lamarckia, and of course no support for machines beyond what the immigrants themselves could transport. The expedition had carried 6 months' food and personal water purification systems. They also took selected traditional seed stock, grains, some fruit and lumber trees, a few herbs and ornamentals. Though Lamarckia lacked the complex terrestrial ecosystem to make farming easy, these monoculture crops had been designed by humans to need nothing more than human-supplied chemicals. In effect, humans were their essential ecosystem. The chemicals, the immigrants believed, could be found or synthesized on Lamarckia. The immigrants took no animals. For machines, they transported 3 small factories for making tools and electronics, and 20 multipurpose tractors, all capable of self-repair. In one way, Lenk had stuck to his divaricate beliefs. The immigrants had refused to take Nutrifors, highly efficient artificial organics that could easily have fed them indefinitely. Nutrifors, however, had not existed in Nader's time, and the good man had been highly suspicious of genetic engineering. Janos accompanied me to the chambers in Axis Nader where the informer now resided. His name was Darrow Janfema. He was a small, worried man, dressed in simple dun-colored clothes. Now that he had regained his health, in decidedly advanced medical conditions not favored by divaricates, he was eager to tell his story again, to provide all the details he knew. He told Janos and me of Moonrise, the village and ferry landing near his point of exit, the most likely place for the emergence of a new gate, of the towns and travel routes by river and sea, the short history of the Lenk immigrants. Privations, arguments over the planning of this one-way voyage, rivalries between quickly split factions, the unavoidable politics of any group of people of that size. And more about Lamarckia's biology, what little Lenk's immigrants had come to understand. At the last, contrite, weeping, perhaps only half-rational, the informer had told us of the Adventists, an opposition group formed to resist Lenk's rule. They had never been very effective. They waited for the Hexamon to send people to bring them back to Thistledown. In each village, he said, they had placed an operative to prepare the way for the Hexamon. Rumors of Hexamon investigators had acquired the status of folk myth, but nobody had come. Darrow Janfema had argued with his fellow Adventists, broken ranks, pretended to serve Lenk, worked his way over a year into Lenk's inner council, and stolen the clavicle. "Why did you take so long?" the informer asked plaintively. "I had to lie, to do so many evil things." Finally, he whispered his confession to the sins of his people. "We have sullied the many mothers of life." Then, smiling as if about to give me a gift, "Lamarckia is not a bad place to die." I did not believe that. He had left, after all.
I began my training.
Janosch accorded me all the resources I needed, and I made appointments to have all my supplements removed. That would have pleased my mother, but of course she would not know.
The spindle-shaped silver flagship coursed down the center of the way at 300 kilometers per second. I sat in one of two well-padded white seats in the ship's nose blister and stared ahead into a funnel-shaped brightness that seemed full of eerie promise. I was caught between numbness, exaltation, and simple terror. I fingered the pink patches at the base of my skull and on my wrist, feeling a new loneliness. Since the death of my father, I had given myself a variety of mental enhancements not condoned by him. Tiny devices in my head and neck that sped thoughts, improved memory, gave me certain abilities and knowledge bases, and also made direct internal connections to city memory, to millions of individuals and thousands of libraries. To pass undetected among the linked divaricates, who carried no such implants, I had been stripped of my extra voices and eyes and minds. Within my thoughts, there was only my own self now. I felt a peculiar embarrassment. I was naked in a way that had nothing to do with clothing or revealed flesh. The flagship began its long, gentle deceleration. Barely 4 meters from where I sat, the flaw glowed pink, brightening as the clamps spaced within the middle of the ship applied pressure. It was not friction that slowed the ship, but the clamp's intrusion into a forbidden region of space-time.
"Greetings, Ser Omi Ap Senon." Gate-opener Frederick Rye Ornis, tall and thin as a praying mantis, stretched and bent himself into the blister beside me, slid his trunk into the seat and let its plush white cushions enfold his hips and chest. "How long since you've hugged the flaw?"
Whatever my concessions to progressive Geshul fashions and technologies, I had at least kept my natural body plan. Rye Ornis was of the new breed that explored more radical shapes. "A few years, and never this far north," I said.
"Not many of us have been this far,"
Rye Ornis said with a rueful look.
"Not recently. The Jarts are less than 1,000,000 kilometers from here."
He stretched a long five-jointed finger and pointed elegantly ahead. Gate-openers, such as Rye Ornis, had acquired immense power and prestige. Part of me envied him.
"1 hour until we go down to the wall," Rye Ornis said. "I'm not looking forward to this."
"Why?" I asked. Rye Ornis gave me a dour glance.
"Anxious to begin your first mission?" he asked.
"I suppose," I said, grinning.
"Ready to show your loyalty to the Hexamon Nexus, ripe for adventure?"
My grin faded at his sardonic tone. I shrugged against the green and purple glow of the tracting fields.
"You don't have to find this place again," Rye Ornis complained.
He grimaced ruefully.
"It's been accessed by amateurs. I can imagine what they did to isolate and pull up the right world line. They've probably mangled the embryonic gate and reduced our accesses to at most 3 or 4. So, I have no room for error. If I fumble a few world lines, it's a one-way trip for you, and Lamarckia is of no use to anybody."
I did not like Rye Ornis much. Most gate openers made me nervous. Their talents were on such a different plane, their personalities radically opposed to my own. The minutes stretched. Rye Ornis seemed mesmerized by the endless spectacle outside the blister. He leaned across the gap between our seats.
"Frankly, the council members and administrators have too much on their minds. If Lamarckia was really important, don't you think they'd have expended more effort than sending just you?"
My emotions burst forth in a wry laugh.
"The thoughts occurred to me," I admitted. "Why did you agree to do this?"
"It suits me," I said.
"Why did you?"
Rye Ornis grimaced again, his face contorting like a circus mask.
"Among the gate openers, advancement comes at the expense of obedience. Is it the same in way defense?"
"I don't know," I said, not entirely truthful. "I'm only a 7. Rye Ornis stared at me.
"Even so," he said. "Can you get me to Lamarckia?"
"Blunt questions deserve blunt answers," he said. He took a deep breath.
Unfortunately, I don't know.
The floor ship had slowed to a few thousand kilometers an hour. Soon it would come to a complete stop.
It's not an exact science. Every gate opener has illusions. My illusion is that the more I know about a place, the better I'm able to sniff out its world lines.
In some ways it resembles Earth, I said.
I've read the Dalgesh report. I know the size and rough characteristics. I'm asking for a personal opinion. What makes it so interesting?
I didn't understand what he was getting at. There are humans on it now.
The story about our being able to sniff out humanoid life is quite wrong. That's not what a gate opener looks for. We look for interest.
What do you think is interesting? I asked. Ryornis leaned his head to one side. The tracking fields had withdrawn. We were moving at less than 100 kilometers an hour, and the flaw no longer glowed.
Lamarckia defies all we've learned of evolution and the origins of life.
The informer seems to think it does. He called it a new mother. He thought the immigrants would destroy it.
Now that's interest. Ryornis nodded approval. Big events mark world lines. If Lenk's people are going to reshape the history of a planet...
I'll get you there, he said. The floorship pilot pulled herself forward and poked her head between us.
Enjoying the view? She asked.
Immensely, I said.
We're both nervous, Ryornis said.
The pilot bent her lips and cocked her head with an expression of regret.
Well, this won't reassure you. The Jarts know we're here, no surprise, and we have maybe 30 minutes before they investigate. The borders here are flexible.
She gave us an appraising look.
Not a top priority mission, I take it.
I lifted myself from the seat and went aft. Ryornis followed, staring at the pilot with feigned affront.
Some of us might disagree, he said haughtily.
I found that a clownish response. Perhaps I deserve no better than him. We are, after all, the agents of a measured response, a gamble, not top priority. Ryornis and I descended from the floorship in a small transfer craft. The journey took less than 10 minutes. The deltoid vehicle maneuvered in a cautious spiral. The closer it came to the wall, the more weight it acquired, and contrary to its name, the wall behaved more like a floor, a gravitating surface. The craft landed lightly, with no discernible jolt. Ryornis and I put on light pressure suits. He picked up a box not much larger than his head and tucked it under his arm. We nodded to an eye conveying our images to the pilot waiting in the floorship above. Then we stepped outside. Beneath our boots, the wall felt as hard as rock. Ryornis immediately set out across the bare bronze surface, long legs carrying him 2 meters with each stride. He removed a clavicle from the box, dropped the box carelessly, and immediately gripped the bars of the device, swinging it back and forth ahead of him. I had read of old-fashioned dowsing rods, once a fad on Earth. Ryornis wielded his clavicle in much the same way as an ancient seeker after water. Beneath us lay one of the fabled, fearful regions called geometry stacks, where the way's physics adjusted itself unpredictably, often compared to a wrinkle in the skin of a many-dimensional worm. I did not like the comparison.
This whole region is knotted, the gate opener said, voice rough, his tone between wonder and disgust. What color is it? My God, what does it smell like?
Puzzled by the questions, I did not answer. Best not to interrupt, I decided.
Ryornis continued, Do you know a geometry stack hurts? When we search it, it gives us colossal headaches that are tough to cure. Somebody's clearly been here before us, though. They've left their own kind of dirty fingerprints, bulges, world lines pulled out of place, accesses ruined. My God, what amateurs!
I followed him at a measured pace. I carried nothing. I would take nothing with me but the clothes beneath my pressure suit. All of my baggage was internal. Weeks of training and education, the careful transfer of relevant knowledge from my supplements to biological memory. The pilot's voice sounded in our helmets.
The Jarts are painting us every few seconds. I'd be happier if I could leave soon. Ryornis said, I can't guarantee putting you on Lamarckia at any particular time. His voice dripped disgust. It'll be very difficult to get you to within a decade of when the informer made his temporary gate. Lenk must have left a nipple, a node, or the informer could never have returned at all. But that's gone now.
The gate opener stood straight, his tall, emaciated figure and white suit a startling contrast to our surroundings. Light played tricks in this immense, featureless, shadowless pipe. To stand and stare at the distant curve of the wall, rising above the flat nearness until it arched high overhead, disoriented me even more. I squinted up at the plasma tube, running the length of the floor to a dazzling blur of brightness in the south, illuminating the way for millions of kilometers, but ending not far north of where we stood, leaving the jarts in a darkness all their own. I looked down to keep from getting dizzy. My body had no help overcoming feelings of vertigo. Naked inside. The gate opener bent over, gripping the bars of the clavicle, passing its spherical head a few centimeters above the surface.
"Found something," he announced. "Knots retied. Some attempt to renormalize, to heal, apparently."
"Heal?" I asked. Ryornis did not hear or simply ignored me.
"Most of these lines pour out into empty expanse. So much desolation, measure without interest, makes us all very lonely. Here a solitary star, there an airless ball of rock. So easy to be attracted by false worlds, dreams of futures not yet accessible, not yet quite real. 10 years, 20 years, maybe 24 years, no guarantees. I might drop you before Lenk's immigrants arrived. Wouldn't want that. And no way to return for any of you. Must be careful to leave a few more accesses."
"Please do," I said, shivering. I had pictured this time as a trouble-free interlude, a brief moment watching the precise and even inhuman work of a master gate opener. Instead, the assistants to the presiding minister had assigned this stick figure, this insect man with his long face and propensity to babble. Perhaps they really do want to lose me.
"Found something. Come here, Ser Olmi."
Ryornis beckoned for me to step closer and watch. I walked up beside him and peered at the cryptic display between the bars of his clavicle. Ryornis drew his gloved finger lightly over the colors on the display.
"See this?"
I saw only twisted lines, flashing fields of green and blue.
"An access. It tells me it's a locus of extreme interest. Nothing around it. No doubt that's Lamarckia. And it follows chronologically what must be the Lenk axis. But where do I shift it? Where do I drop you in Lamarckia's world line? Here to here," stretching across the display with his finger. "Comparative boredom, boredom, nothing. But here," he smiled radiantly behind his visor, "these are exquisite loci. I look for things of interest to humans, Ser Olmi, and I find them. If Lamarckia is of interest all by itself, then these points on its world line are even more interesting to us, to you and me. Understand?"
"No," I said. Ryornis shifted his finger again, waving the clavicle gently.
"Loci of large human-centered events. Lamarckia is a huge event behind them, unfamiliar, but definitely ready to change. Shall I place you at one of the most fascinating loci, Ser Olmi?"
"Just get me there," I said. I bit my lower lip, trying to still my growing anxiety. Courage seemed a sorry abstraction.
"Within a decade or two of Lenk's access, can't be certain. It's really the best I can do."
"Do it. Please just do it." I had already disgraced my family and the memory of my father by cleaving to the progressive Geshels and putting unnatural devices within my body, by signing up in Way Defense, by rejecting the woman I had pledged to. I did not want to disgrace myself again by failing here and now.
"No reason to be nervous. No gate will open if I can't put you someplace truly interesting."
I wanted to hit the man.
"So I spread my carpet here, and dub this gate number 32 of Stack Region 12.
Ryornis traced a glowing red line on the wall with the sphere of the clavicle.
"Stand aside."
I stood aside. A bump rose from the surface of the way, 5 meters wide, with a dimple in the middle. Red and green lines danced across its fresh surface, vibrated rapidly, and became the familiar color of fresh bronze. Ryornis spread it by backing away, trailing the clavicle behind him. A disc-shaped canopy grew over the new gate, mouth dry as stone, head cold as ice. I climbed the side of the bump on hands and knees, perched on the rim of the dimple, and stared down into a storm of fluid darkness.
"It'll take you where you need to go," Ryornis said. "And it will vanish after you."
I stood erect on the lip of the gate, pushed by the very last of my limited courage. I would walk straight ahead in a straight line and come out where the informer had left Lamarckia.
"Just walk," the gate opener said, voice hollow in my helmet. "Don't forget to remove your suit halfway across. There will be air from Lamarckia in the gate at that point."
"All right," I said.
"Only 2 more accesses left, I judge. How you'll come back, I don't know. Good luck."
I looked over my shoulder, saw the gaunt white-suited figure, the eye-twisting uniformity beyond and above, turned, and met another kind of illusion even more extreme. Here there were no straight lines, would never be any unswerving paths. In the gate, I would crawl through a hole punched into all possible worlds, a fistula between the way and somewhere else. I had to put complete faith in Ryornis. My body did not think that was wise. I clenched my teeth, pushed one leg forward, then the other, felt the pressure build around me. I removed the suit and dropped its pieces on the gate's slope behind me. I now wore only the clothes that might be worn by one of Lenk's immigrants. I could no longer see the way or Ryornis.
"Gates pressurized! Hurry!"
The gate opener's voice echoed around me like the buzz of an insect issuing from the discarded suit. Ahead, I saw a swirl of purple and red and black, bands of blue, and a bright arc of yellow-orange. My destination, viewed through the distorting lens of the gate. I closed my eyes, held out my arms, made one last step forward, and fell feet first into lumpy wet soil, spattering my boots and brown pants. For a moment I thought I would fall over. I held out my hands, knelt with boots firm in the muck, and steadied myself. Behind me the wheeling darkness dilated to a point, sucked at my coat's fabric, and abandoned me in a tiny eddy of air. 1. The sun hung 2 handspans above the horizon. Late morning, early evening, I could not judge. I stood on the crest of a low hill between thick black trunks smooth as glass. Behind me, a dense enclosure of more black trunks. And ahead, detail rushed upon me. I sucked it in with frantic need. Red and purple forest pushed over low boxy hills, fading to pink and lavender as the hills receded toward the horizon. Mist curled languidly between. Immense trees like the skeletons of cathedral towers punctuated the forest every few hundred meters, pink crowns perched atop 4 slender vaulting legs, rising high over the rest of the forest. Above the hills, sky beckoned crystal blue with mottled patches of more red and purple, as if reflecting the forest. In fact, the forest inhabited the sky. Tethered gas-filled balloons ascended from the distant stands of black-trunked trees into thin, shredded ribbon clouds. Everything glowed with serene yellow light and brilliant, blood-hued life. Everything. Related. For as far as the eye could see, what Darrow John Fema had called Elizabeth's Zone. One creature. One thing. From where I stood at the top of a rise overlooking the broad, dark, olive Terra Nova River, Lamarckia hardly seemed violated. Not a human in sight, not a curl of smoke or rise of structure. Somewhere below, hidden in the tangle of smooth black trunks, huge round leaves, and purple fans, the ferry landing was supposed to be. And inland, a few hundred meters along a dirt and gravel path, both hidden in the dense pack, the village of Moonrise. I touched my clothes self-consciously. How out of place would I look? I realized I had been holding my breath. I inhaled deeply. It was a sweet and startling breath. The air smelled of fresh water, grapes, tea leaves, and a variety of odors I can only describe as skunky sweet. Rich aromas wafted from nearby extrusions resembling broad purple flowers with fleshy centers. They smelled like bananas, spicy as cinnamon. The extrusions opened and closed, twitching at the end of each cycle. Then they withdrew altogether with thin, high chirps. I reached out my hand to stroke the smooth black curve of a trunk. At my touch, the bark parted to form a kind of stoma, red and pink pulp within. A drop of translucent white fluid oozed from the gash, which quickly closed when I lifted my hand. "Not a tree," I murmured. The Dalgish report by the original surveyors had called them arborid scions, and this was not a forest, but a silva. There were no plants or animals as such on Lamarckia. The first surveyors, in the single day they had spent on the planet, had determined that within certain zones, all apparently individual organisms, called scions, in fact belonged to a larger organism, which they had called an ecos. No scion could breed by itself. They did not act alone. An ecos was a single genetic organism, creating within itself all the diverse parts of an ecosystem spread over large areas, in some cases dominating entire continents. Each ecos was ruled, the surveyors had theorized, by what they called a seed mistress or queen. Neither the surveyors, nor the immigrants, according to John Fema, had ever seen such a queen, however. Understanding of Lamarckian biology and planetary science in general had still been primitive among the immigrants when the informer left. Above, the black trunks spread great round parasol leaves, broad as outstretched arms, powdery gray at their perimeters, rose and blood red in their centers. The parasols rubbed edges in a canopy-clinging current of air, making a gentle shushing noise, like a mother calming an infant. Black, granular dust fell in thin drifts on my head. Not pollen, certainly not ash. I rubbed some between my fingers, smelled it, but did not taste. The last light of the orange sun warmed my face. So this was not morning, but evening. The day was ending. I savored the glow. It felt wonderfully, thrillingly familiar. But it was the first sunlight I had ever directly experienced. Until now, I had spent my whole life within Thistledown and the Way. My terror passed into numb ecstasy. The sense of alien newness, of unfamiliar beauty, hit me like a drug. I was actually walking on a planet, a world like Earth, not within a hollowed-out rock. Reluctantly, I turned from the sun's warmth and walked in shadow down an overgrown trail. If I had come out in the right place, this trail would lead to the Terra Nova River and the landing that served the village of Moonrise. Here, I had been told, I might catch a riverboat and travel to Calcutta, the largest town on the continent of Elizabeth's land. I wondered what sort of people I would meet. I imagined feral wretches, barely social, clustered in dark little towns, immersed in their own superstitions. Then I regretted the thought. Perhaps I had spent too much time among the Geshels, having so little respect for my own kind. But of course, Lenk's people had gone beyond my own kind. Janosch had characterized them as fanatic. The moist air of the river valley sighed around me like an invisible chilly flood. Picking my footsteps carefully, avoiding lines of finger-sized orange worms topped by feathery blue crests, I listened for any sounds, heard only the rubbed silk hiss of air and the liquid mumble of the river. The trail at least had once been traveled by humans. Dropped between the trunks in a tangle of stone-hard roots, I spotted a small scrap of crumpled plastic and knelt to pick it up. Spread open by my fingers, it was a blank page from an erasable notebook. At least, I realized with considerable relief, I had not arrived before the human intruders. That would have meant I was truly trapped here, with no chance of returning until they arrived, or someone came from the Hexamon to get me. I pocketed the scrap. I still could not be sure how much time had passed since the arrival of Link and his followers. 4,114 illegal immigrants. As much as 3 decades between my arrival and theirs. What could they have done to Lamarckia in that time? I pushed through a tangle of purple helixed blades. My feet sank into a grainy, boggy humus littered with pink shells and pebbles. No landing visible. No lights. No sign of river traffic. For a moment, I knelt and dug my fingers into the soil. It felt gritty and resilient at once, grains of sand and spongy cork-like cubes half a centimeter on a side, suspended in inky fluid that globbed immiscibly amid drops of clear water. It looked for all the world like gardener's potting soil mixed with viscous ink. I picked up a pink shell, spiral, flat, like an ancient earth ammonite, 4 or 5 centimeters across. I sniffed it, clean and sweet, with a watery, dusty smell backed by a ghost of roses and bananas. I poked it with a finger. It crushed easily. More black powder fell in thin curtains nearby. I glanced up and saw what looked like an immense reddish-brown snake banded with deep midnight blue, dozens of meters long and as thick across as my own body, twisted around and draped across the trunks and leaves above. It wriggled slowly, peristaltically. I could see neither its head nor its tail. With a clamping sensation in my throat and chest, I trotted down the trail, trying to get out from under the serpent. The trail became thicker, overgrown by smaller red and purple plant-like forms, phytids, filling in between the arborids. I lost my way and had to listen for the sound of the river to orient myself. Several minutes passed before I realized I was smelling something out of place, rich and gassy. During my walk, I had not once smelled mold or methane, not once felt the squelch of dead vegetation. Plants, trees, convenient words only, grew from soil that might have been prepared by diligent and cleanly gardeners. Only the pink shells mired in the mud gave a hint that anything here lived, then died, and in dying left remains. And this fresh scent of decay. I thrashed down to the bank again and stared over the deep brownish water to the black silhouette of the opposite shore. Faint, broad patches of blue glow sprang up between the trees across the river. They sputtered and went out again. I could not be sure I had seen them. Then, high above, the undersides of the broad parasols flashed blue. Somewhere, high-pitched, tuneless whistling. A flutter beneath the parasols, dark-winged things carrying fibrous scraps. Something small and red darted past my face with an audible sniff. The wind died. The night air sank. Fog danced and twisted in the middle of the river. With the silence came another whiff of decay. Animal flesh, rotting, I was sure of that much. I followed the scent, back up the bank, stepping gingerly over writhing purple creepers, guided by faint blue flashes through the undergrowth. I found the remains of the trail. Something made a sound between a squeak and a sigh and scuttled on 3 legs out of the undergrowth. A pasty white creature the size of a small dog, triangular in shape. It stood by a black trunk and regarded me through patient, empty eye spots mounted along a red central line. It pulsed and made tiny whistling sounds. Its skin crawled in what I took to be disgust at my presence. But apparently disgust was only disapproval, or something else entirely, for it did not retreat. Instead, it slowly clasped and crawled its way up a trunk, opened a stoma with a tap of its pointed tail foot, and began to suck milky fluid.
I watched in fascination as its white body swelled. Then, half again as large as before, the creature dropped from the trunk, landed in the dirt with a rubbery plop, and crabbed away with a half-circling gait on the downbent points of its triangle. Twilight was quickly obscuring everything. A double oxbow of stars pricked through the thin clouds. Ahead, a flickering orange light drew my attention. A torch or flame. I pushed toward the orange light and found the landing and the dirt road that pointed inland to Moonrise. The landing began as a broad platform at the end of the road, then narrowed to a long pier. On the platform, a figure squatted beside a lantern. Human, small. Other shapes sprawled on their backs or stomachs on the landing and the pier. In the broad smear of starlight and the lantern's dim glow, I saw that the dark shapes were also human, and still. Their stillness and the careless way they sprawled on the dock platform told me they were not alive. They had been dead for some time. Lying in blotches of dried blood, they had bloated in the sun and now strained at their clothes, as if having surrendered themselves to a feast of violence. My eyes abruptly filled with a sheen of tears. I had expected anything but this. The figure near the lamp wore a tattered, mud-spattered brown shirt and long skirt. Its head was bowed and its breath came harsh and shallow. My foot made a hollow thud on the platform. The figure turned quickly with surprising grace and raised a long-barreled black pistol. It was a woman, brown face muddy and pinched, eyes slitted. The lamp probably half-blinded her. She could only see my outline.
"Who are you?"
she asked, voice quavering. "I've come to take the ferry," I said. I put a strident note into my voice. "Star, Fate, and Yuma, what happened?" The woman laughed softly, bitterly, and pointed the pistol squarely at my chest.
"My husband," she said. "He went with Baze."
"Please," I said, "tell me what happened."
"Do you know him? Janos Strick, my husband? Do you know Baze?"
"No," I said. Neither of those names had been on the list of immigrants, I was sure.
"You can't be anybody. Didn't know my husband. He was very important around here."
"I'm frightened," I said, trying for her sympathy. "I don't know what happened here."
"They'll kill us all."
She stood slowly, pushing on her knee with one hand as if it pained her. The gun remained pointed at my chest. Her eyes were wild, light gray perhaps, yellow in the lantern light. She seemed ancient, face cramped with pain, streaked with tears and mud and dried blood.
"You must be one of them," she said sharply, and pulled back the hammer.
"One of who?" I asked plaintively, not having to work to sound frightened. It could all end here before I was fairly started. It could all really end.
"I'll keep you here," the woman said with a note of weary decision. "Someone will come soon from the north. They took our radios."
The Divaricates had not brought weapons with them, the informer had said. Yet this gun was metal, heavy, smoothly machined to judge by the sound. Bullets probably charged with explosive powder. A primitive but very effective weapon. Her language was recognizably first-century trade, common in Thistledown, but the accent sounded marginally different. I kept my hands visible. The woman shifted from foot to foot, eyes straying to look into the darkness beyond the lantern circle. "Who killed them?" I asked.
"The Bryanists," she said. "You dress like them."
"I'm not one of them," I said. "I've been in the forest studying Calder's Zone south of here. Zone 2. I didn't know about this."